The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis. Welcome to the Social Studio.
Hi, I'm Trevor Dan. You've found the weekly podcast from Radio Today. On this edition, top audio engineer and studio designer Eddie Veal tells us what makes a radio studio sound good and why, controversially perhaps, lots of glass isn't necessarily a bad thing. But first, BBC Local Radio. It's announced that it's rolling back the news and bringing back the personalities. Or as controller David Holdsworth says, put simply, we need to avoid stifling the personality while continuing to inform, champion and challenge. All this in response, one imagines, to the steady fall in its audience from nearly 10 million to less than 9 million in the past 10 years, a period when their target audience of over 55s has been growing and both Radio 2 and Radio 4 have seen substantial growth. So to discuss what's going on with the BBC's 39 English local stations, I'm joined by the journalist and commentator Rob McKenzie, who, after a distinguished career running Radio 1's Newsbeat, spent a few months recently working in BBC local radio. So, Rod, welcome to the Radio Today programme. And did you see this coming?
Thanks, Trevor. Well, yes, I think I saw this coming. The decline in BBC local radio figures has been going on for a while now, as you say. If you look back at 2010, it looked to be in pretty rude health, 10 million listeners. But as you say, the older population's increased and its figures have gone down. It's been a gradual decline and it hasn't been everywhere, but it is worrying. And, you know, I think there are a number of reasons for that. But certainly, you know, the critics have said it's been an emphasis on news and very serious output, heavy going, high fibre output, which has made some people vote with their feet.
I guess the question here is, what do we mean by news? You know, you spent a career at Newsbeat where you had to define news within an entertainment format. It has seemed to me recently that BBC Local Radio's definition of news has become, as you said, very high fibre.
I think that's right. You know, there is a high fibre offering in the market from Radio 4 and, you know, quite right too. But I think some BBC local radio stations have interpreted that with real consequences for the people who listen. And they find it a hard listen, a difficult listen in the morning. You know, they want to be cheered up. They want to be sent with a sprig on their step to the gardening or whatever they're doing. And one of the things I think David Holdsworth's trying to do now is to think a little bit more about production and presentation skills, which kind of goes back to, you know, the Radio 1 experience, if you like. Some of the stuff you're going to be talking about is quite difficult for audiences. So how do you dress it up and make it accessible for those people? And the other thing that they're doing in English regions, local radio, which I think is right, is to review the music policy and the way it's scheduled on air. Because when I went there, I was really surprised to discover that effectively, the playlist has 1,000 songs. And, you know, that doesn't seem to be coherent. And I think the music policy is far too devolved to be, you know, a sensible one. There's some very good specialist programmes. I wouldn't mess with those. But in the daytime, I think the music needs looking at as well. And that seems to have struck a chord.
I think the BBC local radio idea of a few years ago was, our audience is getting older, so the way to get younger people is to play some Spandau Ballet tracks, and that'll get people in their 40s to come on board. I'm not sure that worked, and I do agree with you that their playlist is extremely limited. It seems odd, really, to hear the same records over and over again when they can play pretty well anything they like.
It's a good point. You talk there about the audience focus. Well, David Holdsworth's very clear that they're still going for a core audience of between 50 and 70, while not overlooking the over 70s, of course, who've been with local stations for a very, very long time. So music is a good point, but I think overall, BBC local radio is and will remain a predominantly journalistic offering, and that gives it real distinctiveness, which is great, and helps it in the light of the BBC Trust review of the corporation's local stations, which is obviously happening this year. So journalism has got to remain at the heart of the proposition, but it doesn't have to be relentlessly being hammered over the head with serious news journalism. Journalism takes all shapes and forms, as we know, and presenting it well and doing it with occasionally a light touch is very helpful.
Let me ask you about the whole business of mixing music and speech. I think there was a time when we could see that with the proliferation of stations, we'd see more, if you like, specific genres. So we'd see a 90s station, we'd see a speech station, we'd see a country station. The idea of a mixed output seemed to be being challenged. Radio 2 has clearly made that work. Do you think it's possible at breakfast time to, as it were, interrupt the journalism with the music and interrupt the music with the journalism?
It's a good question. It's a very hard mix. I think it all depends on your presenter. And one of the difficulties, it seems to me, that English local radio has is if you hire, as a presenter, a journalist who doesn't really have much of a feeling for music presentation, that's what you're going to get. You're going to get an uncomfortable mix. And I still hear local radio stations with no back announcing of tracks or love for the music, which is so important.
And you could argue, I suppose, Rod, that that same issue, which is the journalists don't get the music, is also applicable to some of the management, because since local radio was rolled into television, you do find that people editing the radio services are actually TV journalists.
Well, that's, that's a fair point. We're talking about individuals here and, you know, everyone is different. But I think that what the game changer for local radio, if you like, was the decision by the BBC to take its control away from BBC Radio and put it in the hands of BBC News, which seems like a kind of weird piece of BBC politics to most people, but its effect was to journalise, if you like, or formally journalise the whole of BBC local radio and give them an enormous impetus about doing news and being distinctive with, you know, hard-hitting journalism. Great in itself, but not if the audience don't like it. And that's the consequence that we're now dealing with.
Where I live, and I know every area of England is different, but where I live, there's a very interesting contrast between the two stations that are, as it were, either side of me to the east and west, and I won't say which ones they are. But one of them is quite old-fashioned and rather heritage in its style, and it has that, what I call their bedside manner. There's a bit of a sense of, hello, everyone, how are you today? And the one on the other side of me is a much more brash programme with a rather shouty presenter and people joining in a much more, younger, more energetic kind of way. As you were travelling the country, did you hear some disparity between the styles of the stations?
Oh, definitely. And I think in many ways that's a good thing, because sometimes you're reflecting the area. Well, you're always reflecting the area in which you live, but you're reflecting the divergence of people where you live. For example, Radio York, they have a very different feeling. They're effectively a large rural area centred around York, and they do have a very different flavour from London or Manchester, for example, or, you know, Birmingham. So I think that's inevitable, and that should be the case. The question is, have the station managers read the audience right, and do the audience like that different tone that you're getting from those two stations? And is that reflected in the audience figures?
There's been some speculation, hasn't there, in light of John Whittingdale's arrival on the scene, that local radio might possibly be a casualty of any further cutbacks at the BBC. I must say, personally, I don't think this is likely, because MPs will never vote to get rid of a bunch of stations that they love being on. But do you think there's a real sense of anxiety within BBC local radio that it might be for the chop?
I think there's a lot of anxiety, not just in BBC local radio, but across the BBC at the moment about everything that's going on. Certainly, you know, some of the people I talk to in local radio are very, very worried. Like you, I think that it's almost impossible to envision a BBC without some sort of local radio type output. But of course, we also have to look at digital, and that is absolutely crucial. And it's interesting to note, for example, that the BBC and local radio is going to roll out what it calls its local live offering to all areas by next summer. And that's really about making, an online offering, a coherent local, what we call local radio, if you like, online offering available to everyone. Because a lot of their audience are capable of consuming output on the internet. I was once told when I went to English local radio that our audience aren't online, and that's clearly nonsense when you look at 50 to 70-year-olds today and older. And it's good that we, in the sense of the radio industry generally, and they, in the sense of BBC local radio, are waking up to that.
Rod, in a nutshell then, is it worth £115 million? You know, there'll be people listening to this who work in commercial radio who'll be only too well aware that, as Roy Martin, Radio Today's editor, wrote recently, you know, if you go to work for the BBC, you get twice as much money for working half as hard. I'm not sure that's true, but it's certainly a view you hear expressed. David Holdsworth, I see, is paid 160,000 of your English pounds per year. These are big sums of money that the BBC is spending. Do you think the listener gets their money's worth?
I think they do, actually. I think this is a matter of tone rather than journalism. If you invest in journalism, it will cost you money as a business, and everyone knows that. And commercial radio, by and large, has taken a decision that investing in expensive original journalism and investigative journalism is simply not worth it in terms of a financial return. And I think that's right. So the BBC should cover that, because local news and holding to account local decision makers and regional decision makers is very important. It's part of a democracy. And BBC local radio supports that. Some of the points you raise are about a culture. Should the BBC journalists be paid what they are? I think it's probably fair that they are. Are they always working as hard as they should? And are there some people who are not pulling their weight? Well, that is a big debate that happens every day inside the BBC. And what the BBC does about performance managing those who don't come up to scratch is something, you know, that probably needs looking at. And at the moment, it's too tricky to handle.
Yes, well, thank goodness for you and me that we don't have to handle it anymore, Rod.
Indeed.
That's all I'm saying. Rod McKenzie, thank you so much. That was very enlightening. We wish you well in whatever life is taking you through. And talk to you very soon, I hope, Rod.
Thanks, Trevor.
That was Rod McKenzie. Let's have some news now from Roy Martin.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.
Bauer continues to reorganise itself this week, concentrating on Liverpool. Radio City has submitted a request to Ofcom to move City Talk to AM with the addition of rock music and much less actual talk, and move Radio City 2 to FM with extra breakfast and drive shows. Ofcom wants to hear from you and what you think on the decision before making a move. And it's reported commentary of Liverpool and Everton games are being pulled from Radio City after generations have grown up listening to it. I think it's something like 40 years it's been on there ever since it launched. More details on this breaking story on radiotoday.co.uk. And sticking with the BBC, the BBC Press Office has confirmed to Radio Today that there will be no reduction in news programming on any BBC local radio station, even though the network is changing direction to add more music and add more personality into its output. Time will indeed tell on this one. That's the very latest from radiotoday.co.uk. I'm Roy Martin.
Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis, offer you elegantly integrated products and intelligent one-stop shopping for all your studio needs. Discover a full range of innovative studio products. Play out by Wide Orbit, Music Master Scheduling, Stirlitz, Newsboss, Larvo, Telos, Axia, Omnia, Digigram and Commotion. Visit bionics.co.uk today.
Thank you very much, Roy. By the way, we have approached BBC Local Radio for a comment, but no one's as yet been available. We're hopeful, though, that David Holdsworth will be here next week. So if you've got any questions for him, please get them into me. And now,
sound.
I've been banging on for a while about how radio studios have got too much glass in them. In some studios, BBC London for instance, you can actually hear what's going on in the next door cubicle, and presenters have to be told to keep the volume of their speakers down. In others, I think the sound is too bright, too noisy, too distracting because of the reflective surfaces, which I was always told were best avoided. So to find out more, I've been to see one of the country's leading acoustic engineers and studio designers. He's called Eddie Veal, and he works for just about every radio company you can name and designs rooms for film and for music production too. Not for the first time, it seems, I'm wrong about glass.
Well, I very much like glass in studios. I think they introduce a human element into studios that makes them far better places to work in. It all comes down to the understanding of how acoustics behave in rooms and how one neutralizes a room. When you start off with the basic room, whatever the room surfaces are, and that includes glass, masonry, whatever, the first thing that we do in our design is to neutralize the room. We then introduce the acoustics that the studio needs, because all studios, whatever they're going to do, have different acoustical needs. Some studios need to be quite dead, others need to be live. And as you start to introduce liveness to studios, the quality of the liveness is important because it impacts on different instruments, different voices, different sounds in different ways. So it's all about neutrality and support for what's going to be produced in that studio. Glass, I'm a great advocate of. I think I might have been one of the first to introduce glass into commercial radio studios. But my desire for glass goes back an awful long time. It goes back to the late 60s when I relocated a company called AdVision from Bond Street across to Gosfield Street and introduced daylight to studios, music studios, which was pretty much unknown at that time. Most of them were in basements, and there were times of the year when you never saw daylight. And my first foray into commercial radio was with Beacon Radio in Wolverhampton. It was my first encounter with the IBA as well. And in the plans that I drew up for the studios, I had external windows. And the IBA queried this, whether it's wise. I said, well, how, if a presenter's on air and the weather forecast says it's sunny and it's raining outside, how do they know? From there, we've gone on to design studios with quite a lot of glass. But there are limits. If you want to have a respectable acoustic, there is a limit to how much glass you can have in a studio. So if I was asked, can I have an all-glass studio? The answer is no.
Can I talk to you about the sound then in a studio? I mean, we're having this conversation in the breakfast room in your house, which has got quite a high ceiling. Now, you wouldn't recommend this as the right acoustic for a radio studio, would you?
No, I wouldn't. The reason being that in a radio studio, you've got a microphone, which is a lovely device, but can be uncompromising. And the microphone doesn't hear things the same way as we do. We've got a brain that is attached to our ears, and we're able to filter out lots of things that the ears receive. And what a microphone hears is often radically different to what we hear.
So does it matter if my radio studio has got a humming computer in the background and various noisy screens and all that kind of stuff? Does that matter? I mean, it must bother you as an acoustic engineer, but do you think the listener minds?
I think it would be a negative factor as far as the listener is concerned. Operationally, there's various techniques for dealing with it, getting up closer to the microphone, putting filters on if there's a hum, putting a high-pass filter on so you filter it out. There's many techniques available to the operator to reduce disturbance. But at the end of the day, it's the relationship between the presenter and the listener.
Now, that would be an argument for saying, actually, somebody like you is pretty redundant, because if we're a good broadcaster and we have a good relationship with our listener, we could just sit in the downstairs loo.
We could indeed. And there are those that have broadcast from home over the years. Classic FM was a good example in the early days where presenters would actually do their work from home. Listeners tend to not so much hear variances, but they become annoying, and then they tend to tune into something else. And the other aspect in a studio is if you've got guests, trying to control what guests do on microphones or in relationship to microphones is very difficult if you've done any live broadcasting.
And it's quite an important factor, this, isn't it, in modern broadcasting, where there are more programmes that are presented by two, three, even four people. I mean, if you listen to Five Live Breakfast, I mean, you can almost hear the people walking in and out of the studio. Maybe that's just a style of broadcasting that is new and listeners are you know, happier to deal with.
Oh, you're absolutely right there. Thinking back to the beginnings of Virgin Radio and our ginger hair friend, some of the things that he did, I think, made engineers wince at the time. But hey, you know, what's radio about? It's about engaging with the audience. And if that engagement is an off-the-wall programme, does it really matter? In the short term, probably not. It's only when you get regular listeners and perhaps they like listening to the programme in the background, and then other acoustic events start to annoy them. Then they start to think about what they're listening to and is there an alternative.
I want to drill down a little bit into the world of the acoustic engineer then. So if I'm on the air simply talking into a microphone and assume I haven't got any guests, what are the important things that I need to have in my room, you know, in my studio?
Very little, really. So you can quite easily position microphones, select microphones for their characteristics, and have a very intimate relationship with the microphone. It depends how flexible. It depends what sort of program you're doing, because if you're doing a program where you've got interaction with Facebook or other media, and you want to be operating mice, keyboard, looking at screens, diverting attention from the screen immediately in front of you to one over at the periphery, there will be a tendency to go off mic. The presenter is no longer just a voice, they're actually an engineer as well. And to be able to be effective at the engineering task, they need to be able to move around. I know some have tried headsets, but they don't seem to be light. Not quite sure why. It does seem on the face of it, a good solution, particularly when you see the way that they're used on television. And some are very discreet these days. Not that it matters on radio, because you don't look at them.
Except that, of course, radio studios increasingly have TV cameras in them.
Oh, indeed they do, yes. It's the spy on the wall.
Okay, so talking of professional approaches, yours is a very successful company. You build radio studios, but also recording studios for a huge number of very impressive clients. I wonder whether your business will survive or whether in the future people will just say, do you know what, we don't need a studio. You know, the ultimate cheap studio is to not have one at all. And they could say, oh, well, people love a bit of background noise and a bit of hum and this, that and the other. They like the liveness of it. You know, is yours a dying art, Eddie?
I don't think it is. You've got to listen to some of our younger generation and their perception. Most of them are brought up these days on MP3. And it's when they suddenly discover that there is a different quality of sound that they question what they're listening to.
How do you feel about so many DAB stations being in mono with very low bit rates?
Well, I'm afraid at the end of the day it comes down to cost. I mean, DAB in UK was a great idea. Looking back at it, one can always be critical, and it could have been better. And some of the ideas and expectations and wishes of government aren't coming to fruition. DAB is, in many respects, being constrained, reduced. And again, it's cost.
I mean, you're an acoustic engineer, so you know what things ought to sound like. If you had to listen tonight to something on, let's say, Radio 3 or Radio 2, would you put FM on or would you put DAB on?
Personally, it would be FM, because DAB in this locality where I am is pretty poor. And there's too many dropouts on it.
I do bring this up regularly with Ford Ennals, by the way, at Digital Radio UK. I always talk about the railway bridge in Baldock, which always causes it to drop out, doesn't it?
Yeah. The problem with DAB, well, one of the problems with DAB is you don't get the gentle decline in signal strength as you move around. So you're not able to move around with your receiver, and from the amount of background noise, optimize reception. DAB, the works or it doesn't, and that you have no control over that, no influence, as against FM, where one can always remove the, adjust the position of the receiver or put up a better aerial. With DAB, putting up a better aerial so you get a better signal isn't always the answer, because there's other influences as well that can cause signal dropout.
One final thing then. If I said to you, take me, Eddie, to the state-of-the-art radio studio in the UK right now, where would you take me?
Well, it could be one of three places. It could either be BBC, BH. It could be to Global in Leicester Square. Or it could be to the University of West London. We were commissioned to create two radio studios for them in support of redevelopment of a radio course that they run. We put everything into those studios that is available to radio today. Each studio has the normal broadcast facility. They also have a DJ facility, so that whatever students want to do, they can. Whatever the lecturers want to do by encouraging the students to develop their ideas, their technique, they can do. It's a bit off-piste for most broadcasters, because a lot of broadcasters probably only ever use 50% of what's in those studios. But we were challenged several times by the hierarchy of the university on the basis, do we need to spend so much money? To which my answer was, yeah, and probably a bit more. Because the aspiration there was to be able to provide them with everything that they would need today and probably for the next 3 years in order to give their students the full breadth of experience of what they could encounter in their workplace.
Thank you, Eddie, for talking to us. It's been great listening not only to you, but also to the extraneous noises of Stevenage.
I thought you might like some little bits on the background just to cope with.
Eddie Veal talking to the Radio Today programme. Time now for some radio moments. Here's David.
Radio Moments.
One of the most enduring radio features celebrates its 35th anniversary this week.
OK, so we'll change the names, David and Sally. Those are the names we'll use. The story comes from the north of England. I've got the address, the telephone number and everything, but there's no point in, I don't know, ruining people's lives by exposing them to gossip.
Bit of a shock. One of those experts in radio, David Lloyd, who really does know his stuff and is a mine of information, emailed Seb a couple of days ago and said, do you realise that our tune is...
In the first edition, Sue met Steve on holidays, but then he went off to the army in Germany, and he was never seen again.
And I surprised her with a puppy, kept me up all Christmas Eve, 2 years ago.
And that was the first song on Our Tune. It's 45 years now since the BBC fired Kenny Everett.
Mrs. Mary Payton, wife of the Transport Minister, has passed her advanced driver's test first time. She's been driving more than 30 years, but says she was spurred on to take the test by her husband's appointment. That's the news from the third floor, incidentally. Our next one, 11:30.
She only passed because she crammed a fiver in his hand. I know these people. And now, where were we? Well, about 2 days later, I got a telephone from the third floor of Broadcasting House saying, well, Kenny, it's time for the parting of the ways.
Noel Edmonds was filling in for a sickly Kenny when Noel made his first Radio 1 broadcast this week in 1969.
This is Noel Edmonds saying sincerely, I do hope you've enjoyed the last 2 hours and 5 minutes of my kind of madness. Have a wonderful weekend, have a lovely tomorrow. I hope it's windy and you drown in your boat as well. Keep yourselves fit and fine, wonderful and well. Keep smiling, keep happy. Remember, life is to be enjoyed, not endured.
A young Noel Edmonds who made his debut broadcast for Radio 1 this week in 69. The Radio Radio project, known on air as The Superstation, launched this week in 1988. It provided a late-night sustaining service for a host of commercial stations.
And good evening. And welcome to The Jeff Cooper Show on The Superstation tonight. Me and about 30 engineers around the country.
The Superstation.
The service was carried by many stations, including Piccadilly, County Sound, Ayr and Trent. The project was backed by Branson, operated by Rob Jones and David Campbell, with input from across the industry. It lasted 2 years. It's 76 years now since the birth of this effect.
WKLO!
Yes, the Sonovox effect, which has played a part in radio jingles ever since.
WGH!
WGH in Old Virginia!
This week in 1939, that clever effect was publicised widely for the very first time. This is how it worked. Sound was fed into little speakers on the side of your throat. And those sounds were transmitted then to the larynx, so they came out of the mouth almost as if they were produced there, and then you mouthed the words you wanted. Famous jingle singer Dan Alexander recalls that Bill Meeks from PAMS spotted the opportunity.
Bill came up with the idea, and he'd found it in Los Angeles and got to know the inventor. And of course it was for people who'd had throat problems, a little generator that they could use in place of their vocal cords, basically. But then he got the idea of piping various musical sounds through it.
Do I need to Briticize the accent any?
No.
I mean, is it top rather than top? Or
top.
Top shop, top man!
John Wolford from Jam, and before that, jingle singer extraordinaire Dan Alexander. Local radio came to Hull briefly 54 years ago.
Radio Hull, your local BBC station. The time, 6 o'clock. Well, good morning, it's Michael Barton here in the Guildhall on a rather uncertain morning, a few splashes of rain about, but...
1961, and the BBC's experimental local radio broadcast in Hull goes on there. Those experiments were to pave the way for BBC local stations proper a few years later. 1973 now, and a new idea at Radio 1.
The Radio 1 Roadshow!
Today, live from the Promenade Ilfracombe with Mike...
An amazing turnout from all sorts of places around the coast congregated here at the Promenade at Ilfracombe this morning for the Roadshow, continuing its journey clockwise around the coast of England and Wales.
Memories of the Radio 1 Roadshow, which began this week in Newquay 41 years ago. Less cheery times in commercial radio this week in 77, and the same thing happened again in 78, too.
This is LBC 261 medium wave and 97.3 VHF. Owing to an industrial dispute, normal services on both LBC and Independent Radio News have been suspended for the time being. We hope to resume our regular programming as soon as possible.
LBC journalists on strike over a sacking this week, 37 years ago. Let's finish this week with a taster of that famous John Marsh Radio 2 news bulletin this week, 5 years ago. It was every journalist's nightmare.
The cap has stopped the flow of oil into the sea, but signs of methane gas have been detected. Just give me a moment, if you would, and... We'll carry on. Some people who were on holiday when the tour operator Gold... Kenneth Ogilvy from Ayrshire says at his hotel in Marmaris, people are being intimidated. And I beg your pardon, that's not exactly right either.
Poor old John.
This is all very strange. If you give me some... Give me one moment, we'll see if we can actually get things right. Here we are.
What a shame we haven't got time for it all. So, with Dave Cash celebrating his 73rd birthday...
And then when we went on the air, we found out that it really didn't work as well as we thought it would work.
Grampian TV selling loss-making Scott FM 19 years ago, now hard. John Reith, born 116 years ago...
The government should leave the BBC alone.
...and the death of Marconi, 78 years ago...
...fin dal 1895.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Radio Moments!
Thank you, David Lloyd, also Eddie Veal and Rod McKenzie. Keep up to date with everything that's happening at radiotoday.co.uk, and we'll have another podcast for you next week. This has been a TDC production. I'm Trevor Dan. Thanks for listening.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.